Hi, this is Fanny
Brewster.
Hi, this is Fanny Brewster speaking with you again today on C.G. Jung in his own words on the concept of the mother archetype. We're going to begin reading from psychological aspects of the mother archetype from the aspects of the feminine by Jung. So let's see, this lecture was first published as a lecture in 1938, and then it was later revised in 1954. And the translation was done in 1938. So we'll start today on the concept of the archetype of the mother, and then we'll continue next time with the mother archetype specifically, and then we'll go into the mother complex. So we're going to have several readings from this section, from this chapter, the psychological aspects of the mother archetype. So we'll do it and do the reading and listening for the next approximately 3 weeks. So we start, Jung says, the concept of the great mother belongs to the field of comparative religion and embraces widely varying types of mother goddess. The concept itself is of no immediate concern to psychology because the image of a great mother in this form is rarely encountered in practice, and then only under very special conditions. The symbol is obviously a derivative of the mother archetype. If we venture to investigate the background of the great mother image from the standpoint of psychology, then the mother archetype, as the more inclusive of the two, must form the basis of our discussion. Though lengthy discussion of the concept of an archetype is hardly necessary at this stage, some preliminary remarks of a general nature may not be out of place. In former times, despite some dissenting opinion and the influence of Aristotle, it was not too difficult to understand Plato's conception of the idea as superordinate and pre-existent to all phenomena. Archetype, far from being a modern term, was already in use before the time of St. Augustine and was synonymous with idea in the Platonic usage. When the Corpus Hermeneticum, which probably dates from the 3rd century, describes God as archetypal light, it expresses the idea that he is the prototype of all light. That is to say, pre-existent and superordinate to the phenomenon light. Were I a philosopher, I should continue in this Platonic strain and say, somewhere in a place beyond the skies, there is a prototype or primordial image of the mother that is pre-existent and superordinate to all phenomena in which the maternal, in the broadest sense of the word, is manifest. But I am an empiricist, not a philosopher. I cannot let myself presuppose that my peculiar temperament, my own attitude to intellectual problems, is universally valid. Apparently, this is an assumption in which only the philosopher may indulge, who always takes it for granted that his own disposition and attitude are universal, and will not recognize the fact, if he can avoid it, that his personal equation conditions his philosophy. As an empiricist, I must point out that there is a temperament which regards ideas as real entities and not merely as noumena. It so happens, by the merest accident, one might say, that for the past 200 years, we have been living in an age it has become unpopular or even unintelligible to suppose that ideas could be anything but noumena. Anyone who continues to think as Plato did must pay for his anachronism by seeing the super-celestial, the i.e., that is i.e., metaphysical essence of the idea relegated to the universal realm of faith and superstition, or charitably left to the poet. Once again, in the age-old controversy over universals, the nominalistic standpoint has triumphed over the realistic, and the idea has evaporated. This change was accompanied, and indeed to a considerable degree caused, by the market rise of empiricism, the advantages of which were only too obvious to the intellect. Since that time, the idea is no longer something a priori, but is secondary and derived. Naturally, the new nominalism promptly claimed universal validity for itself, in spite of the fact that it, too, is based on a definite and limited thesis colored by temperament. This thesis runs as follows. We accept as valid anything that comes from outside and can be verified. The ideal instance is verification by experiment. The antithesis is we accept as valid anything that comes from inside and cannot be verified. The hopelessness of this position is obvious. Greek natural philosophy, with its interest in matter, together with Aristotelian reasoning, has achieved a belated but overwhelming victory over Plato. Yet every victory contains the germ of future defeat. Every victory claims the germ of future defeat. In our own day, signs foreshadowing a change of attitude are rapidly increasing. Significantly enough, it is Kant's doctrine of categories, more than anything else, that destroys in embryo every attempt to revive metaphysics in the old sense of the word, but at the same time paves the way for a rebirth of the Platonic spirit. If it be true that there can be no metaphysics transcending human reason, it is no less true that there can be no empirical knowledge that is not altogether caught and limited by the a priori structure of cognition. During the century and a half that have elapsed since the appearance of the Critique of Pure Reason, the conviction has gradually gained ground that thinking, understanding, and reasoning cannot be regarded as independent processes subject only to the eternal laws of logic, but that they are psychic functions coordinated with the personality and subordinate to it. We no longer ask, has this or that been seen, heard, handled, weighed, counted, thought, and found to be logical? We ask instead, who saw, heard, or thought? Beginning with the personal equation in the observation and measurement of minimal processes, this critical attitude has gone on to the creation of an empirical psychology such as no time before ours has known. Today, we are convinced that in all fields of knowledge, psychological premises exist, which exert a decisive influence upon the choice of material, the method of investigation, the nature of the conclusions, and the formulation of hypotheses and theories. We have even come to believe that Kant's personality was a decisive conditioning factor of his critique of pure reason. Not only our philosophers, but our own predilections in philosophy, and even what we are fond of calling our best truths, are affected, if not dangerously undermined, by this recognition of a personal premise. All creative freedom, we cry out, is taken away from us. What? Can it be possible that a man only thinks or says or does what he himself is? Provided that we do not again exaggerate and so fall a victim to unrestrained psychologizing, it seems to me that the critical standpoint here defined is inescapable. It constitutes the essence, origin, and method of modern psychology. There is an a priori factor in all human activities, namely the inborn, preconscious, an unconscious individual structure of the psyche. The preconscious psyche, for example, that of a newborn infant, is not an empty vessel into which, under favorable conditions, practically anything could be poured. On the contrary, it is a tremendously complicated, sharply defined individual entity which appears indeterminate to us only because we cannot see it directly. But the moment the first visible manifestation of psychic life begin to appear, one would have to be blind not to recognize their individual character, that is, the unique personality behind them. It is hardly possible to suppose that all these details come into being only at the moment in which they appear. When it is a case of morbid predispositions already present in the parents, we infer hereditary transmissions through the germ plasma. It would not occur to us to regard epilepsy in the child of an epileptic mother as an unaccountable mutation. Again, we explain by heredity the gifts and talents which can be traced back through whole generations. We explain in the same way the reappearance of complicated instinctive actions in animals that have never set eyes on their parents and therefore could not possibly have been taught by them. Nowadays, we have to start with the hypothesis that, as far as predisposition is concerned, there is no essential difference between man and all other creatures. Like every animal, he possesses a preformed psyche which breeds true to his species and which, on closer examination, reveals distinct features traceable to family antecedents. We have not the slightest reason to suppose that there are certain human activities or functions that could be exempted from this rule. We are unable to form any idea of what those predispositions or attitudes are which make instinctive actions in animals possible. And it is just as impossible for us to know the nature of the preconscious psychic disposition that enables a child to react in a human manner. We can only suppose that his behavior results from patterns of functioning, which I have described as images. The term image is intended to express not only the form of the activity taking place, but the typical situation in which the activity is released. These images are primordial images insofar as they are peculiar to whole species, and if they ever originated, their origin must have coincided at least with the beginning of the species. They are the human quality of the human being, the specifically human form his activities take. This specific form is heredity and is already present in the germ plasm. The idea that it is not inherited but comes into being in every child anew would be just as preposterous as the belief that the sun which rises in the morning is a different sun than that which set in the evening before. Since everything psychic is preformed, this must also be true of the individual functions, especially those which derive directly from the unconscious predisposition. The most important of these is creative fantasy. In the products of fantasy, the primordial images are made visible, and it is here that the concept of the archetype finds its specific application. I do not claim to have been the first to point out this fact. The honor belongs to Plato, the first investigator in the field of ethnology to draw attention to the widespread occurrence of certain elementary ideas was Adolf Bastian. Two later investigators, Hubert and Moss, followers of Durkheim, speak of categories of the imagination, and it was no less an authority than Hermann Usner who first recognized unconscious preformation under the guise of unconscious thinking. If I have any share in these discoveries, it consists in my having shown that archetypes are not disseminated only by tradition, language, and migration, but they can re-arise spontaneously at any time, at any place, and without any outside influence. The far-reaching implications of this statement must not be overlooked, for it means that there are present in every psyche forms which are unconscious, but nonetheless active, living dispositions, ideas in the Platonic sense that preform and continually influence our thoughts and feelings and actions. Again and again, I encounter the mistaken notion that an archetype is determined in regard to its content. In other words, that it is a kind of unconscious idea, if such an expression be admissible. It is necessary to point out once more that archetypes are not determined as regards their content, but only as regards their form, and then only to a very limited degree. A primordial image is determined as to its content only when it has become conscious and is therefore filled out with the material of conscious experience. Its form, however, as I have explained elsewhere, might perhaps be compared to the axial system of a crystal, which, as it were, preforms the crystalline structure in the mother liquid, although it has no material existence of its own. This first appears according to the specific way in which the ions and molecules aggregate. The archetype in itself is empty and purely formal, nothing but a possibility of representation, which is given a priori. The representations themselves are not inherited, only the forms, and in that respect, they correspond in every way to the instincts, which are also determined in form only. The existence of the instincts can no more be proved than the existence of the archetypes, so long as they do not manifest themselves concretely. With regard to the definition of the form, our comparison with the crystal is illuminating, inasmuch as the axial system determines only the stereometric structure, but not the concrete form of the individual crystal. This may be either large or small, and it may vary endlessly by reason of the different size of its plane or by the growing together of two crystals. The only thing that remains constant is the axial system, or rather, the invariable geometric proportions underlying it. The same is true of the archetype. In principle, it can be named and has an invariable nucleus of meaning, but always only in principle, never as regards its concrete manifestation. In the same way, the specific appearance of the mother archetype, the mother image, at any given time cannot be deduced from the mother archetype alone, but depends on innumerable other factors. Continuing, the mother archetype. Like any other archetype, the mother archetype appears under an almost infinite variety of aspects. I mention here only some of the more characteristic. First in importance are the personal mother and grandmother, stepmother, and mother-in-law. Then any woman with whom a relationship exists, for example, nurse or governess, or perhaps a remote ancestress. Then there are what might be termed mothers in a figurative sense. To this category belongs the goddess, and especially the mother of God, the Virgin, and Sophia. Mythology offers many variations of the mother archetype, as for instance, the mother who reappears as the maiden in the myth of Demeter and Kor, or the mother who is also the beloved, as in the Sibyl Attis myth. Other symbols of the mother, in a figurative sense, appear in things representing the goal of our longing for redemption, such as paradise, the kingdom of God, the heavenly Jerusalem. Many things arousing devotion or feelings of awe, as for instance, the church, university, city or country, heaven, earth, the woods, the sea, or any still waters, matter even, the underworld and the moon, can be mother symbols. The archetype is often associated with things and places standing for fertility and fruitfulness, the cornucopia, a plowed field, a garden. It can be attached to a rock, a cave, a tree, a spring, a deep well, or to various vessels, such as the baptismal font, or to vessel-shaped flowers, like the rose or the lotus. Because of the protection it implies, the magic circle, or mandala, can be a form of mother archetype. Hollow objects such as ovens and cooking vessels are associated with the mother archetype, and of course the uterus, yoni, and anything of a like shape. Added to this list, there are many animals, such as the cow, hare, and helpful animals in general. All these symbols can have a positive, favorable meaning or a negative, evil meaning. An ambivalent aspect is seen in the goddesses of fate. Evil symbols are the witch, the dragon, or any devouring and entailing animal, such as a large fish or a serpent, the grave, deep water, death, nightmares, and boogies. This list is not, of course, complete. It presents only the most important features of the mother archetype. The qualities associated with it are material, solicitude, and sympathy. The magic authority of the female, the wisdom and spiritual exaltation that transcend reason, any helpful instinct or impulse, all that is benign, all that cherishes and sustains, that fosters growth and fertility. The place of magic transformation and rebirth, together with the underworld and its inhabitants, are presided over by the mother. On the negative side of the mother archetype may connote anything secret, hidden, dark, the abyss, the world of the dead, anything that devours, seduces, and poisons, that is terrifying and inescapable like fate. All these attributes of the mother archetype have been fully described and documented in my book, Symbols of Transformation. There I formulated the ambivalence of these attributes as the loving and the terrible mother. Perhaps the historical example of the dual nature of the mother most familiar to us is the Virgin Mary, who is not only the Lord's mother, but also, according to the medieval allegories, his cross. In India, the loving and terrible mother is the paradoxical Kali. Shakta philosophy has elaborated the mother archetype into the concept of prakti, matter, and assigned to it the three junas, or fundamental attributes, sata, rajas, tamas, goodness, passion, and darkness. These are three essential aspects of the mother: her cherishing and nourishing goodness, her orgiastic emotionality, and her special feature of the philosophical myth, which shows Prakriti dancing before Purusha in order to remind him of discriminating knowledge, does not belong to the mother archetype, but to the archetype of the anima, which in a man's psychology invariably appears at first mingled with the mother image. So this concludes our reading for today. When we continue next time, we will be starting with the mother archetype. I thank you for listening. And enjoy the rest of your day. I will speak with you soon again. Bye.